Here's the red eye. This is Rob and the regulator on Fifth Fist Radio. This is Rob. We've got Alex, the regular watch regulator, lurking here. And we also have a special guest. Oh, he popped up.
Yeah.
Say hello. Good. And we've also got Michael Woods from, is it Michael Woods Watchmaking, right?
No, it's just Wood. Woods Watchmaking.
Oh, Woods, just Woods Watchmaking.
Woods Watchmaking, yeah,
exactly. Is there another Michael Woods Watchmaking? Did they get the kind of name before you and you had to just shorten it to Woods Watchmaking?
I just didn't want to do my full name. It just sounded too much. I just thought Woods Watchmaking, and then maybe one of the kids can take it over one day.
Brilliant. Yes, that's not a bad strategy. Anyway, we've heard of you. The listeners might have heard Michael the other day on the other, the other segment, the other channel. Of Fifth Wrist, defining time, which is a very, very interesting conversation. We've managed to drag him back again because we just got desperate for people to bring on here. And
I'm feeling confident about this one now.
And here he is again because it was so entertaining last time, and I wanted to have a chat with him. I didn't get to last time. Alex jumped ship and went on to the other channel last time. So I'm going to have my 2 pence worth. Yeah. So welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
What do you call that? A glutton for punishment? Is that what it is?
No, I love it. As you know, I just listened to your podcast with Charles. That was good.
That was a good one. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, are you on a boat, Michael? Are you on a boat or something?
No, I'm sitting in my living room in a dressing gown.
I didn't think we're taking guests in on land anymore. Basically.
Yeah, I said it was after that. It was hovercrafts or hot air balloons, right? That's the minimum level.
An aeroplane, like your Mile High Club type thing.
No, he was. I just liked the fact that he tried to recommend Jet Li to follow on Instagram.
I jumped in. I was like, no. Yeah.
And you were sitting there going, I've heard that name somewhere. Yeah. What are you talking about? It was just the other day. then when he said Jet Li, it clicked with you.
But nobody ever says Jet Li. They're always like, there's somebody called, and then they say the whole name of someone else, and they're like, who is also known as Jet Li. It's never just a simple Jet Li, okay? So it confuses me when I've had like umpteen drinks in a day.
So 10 minutes ago, I actually messaged Charles and said, basically, suck it.
I'm sure he'll love that.
He hasn't replied.
He hadn't actually heard.
He followed me, but he hasn't replied to that message. So maybe he's already unfollowed me.
He just sent me a message just an hour ago because he hadn't heard the podcast yet. So he couldn't, maybe it was on Apple iTunes or whatever. They couldn't, seen it yet. And I said, oh, it'll turn up. Don't worry. I said, it's a ripper. Good guy.
It's weird. When I recorded, we recorded my podcast the other day, Alex. I tried to send it to my watchmaking war step teacher, and he couldn't listen to it because he had some
software or something.
No,
parental block, exactly. Yeah. And because there was some swear words in it, he couldn't get into it.
Where is he in the world?
He's in Switzerland. He's in Neuchâtel,
right? Paul.
Neuchâtel. Yeah.
That's good because we are the number one. This is no joke. We are the number one watch podcast in Switzerland.
How's that possible?
I don't know. I thought it was just all Swatch, HR,
maybe
in people who are listening to the podcast over and over again. But we've got one other person who doesn't work for Swatch Group HR. So that's good.
You could be right there.
Maybe there's some French ones in like French platforms possibly. But maybe not.
I don't know. I think you guys just don't realize how entertaining you are. I think I know. Every walk I go on, I'm like, I've heard they got another episode up because I need to listen to them.
That's good.
Shit.
That's why we brought you on. So you're kind of providing your own content. You can consume your own material. It's good.
We're just gonna sit back here now. You go off. You go.
No, okay. And I'm walking along, listening to you two Muppets just ramble on, and I'm just smiling away. And people are probably looking at me like, "What's he smiling at?"
I'm like at work when I'm at the bench and I laugh out loud and people turn around and they're like, what are you laughing at? And I'm like, God, I just said something so hilarious on my hit podcast, which is number one in Switzerland and Kenya. So, oh yeah, big shout out to all the people in Kenya, all their fan base there.
Thanks, guys.
you're just like, I'm so funny, I can't help it.
What? We've gone 5 minutes. We haven't mentioned drinks yet. That's good.
Okay.
But we can probably get into it. You got a pint of red, probably, Alex, right? And a pint of gin. Okay.
I'm bringing it right along.
Sorry?
No, give me a chance. Okay. So I'm out of pint glasses.
Oh.
So I've had to move to a glass. The last time I had this glass was when I did a podcast with Wine Dined Timed.
Uh-huh.
I actually bumped into JB Hi-Fi today when I had to go and buy new headphones because the cats ate the last ones. So I last had this glass, and it's actually a carafe, but I use it as like a supersized pint glass. So I've got about a third of a carafe of red wine, but I also then went and bought a bottle of rum that JP Melbs was drinking on his podcast.
I bought a bottle of that as well.
Did you?
Yes.
Ron
Zacapa. Yeah.
So I poured a glass of this earlier. So I was drinking red earlier, and then I poured a glass because JP said just to sip it. So I poured a glass, and then I'm drinking away in the red, and then I go to down the rest of the red from the carafe, but I somehow picked up the glass of rum and downed a good three fingers of this rum. I felt like that was like that scene in Pulp Fiction where she accidentally does the heroin instead of the cocaine. Yeah. I was like, my face was like burning, but I just had to drink it. So yeah, I've got some sipping rum, Ron Zacapa 23, and about maybe a half pint of red wine.
Is the rum good? Because having said I bought it, I actually gave it, I was it for a gift. I haven't actually bought myself a bottle yet. I need to probably.
It's good. Like it's pretty good. I don't know if you can really drink it. Well, I'm drinking it straight, but it's...
You drink anything straight.
No, I'm pretty soft for a Scottish guy, but you can sip it, but you still get that kind of that burn, but it's fairly pleasant for when it comes to drinking a rum straight. So those are the two drinks I've got. Just now. I'm actually going to top up just now, so you can move on.
Yeah, go on the top up, and we'll keep talking.
Okay.
What about you, Michael? You're drinking something, obviously. You were going to mix a Negroni or something, rather.
Negroni, I did. How's the audio on mine? Brilliant. Is it sounding okay?
Brilliant. Yeah,
it's fine.
Maybe the alcohol is probably the rum talking, but you sound great, Michael.
Yeah, I know. No, I mixed up a Negroni, but I
nice.
Usually with a Negroni, you have to you put like a slice of orange in there, and I just couldn't be bothered. I've just stopped doing it.
Couldn't do the orange.
I just like it tastes great without it. So I've just ice and the Negroni. So it's
I'm not game to mix main drinks anymore because every time I do, Alex laughs at me. But
it's because you mix beer with stuff.
Not always. Not always. Anyway,
coffee and whiskey, and it's not even the evening. It's not even the morning.
I'm all for experimenting, but Negroni is a bit of the drink of the moment in Europe this summer. It was anyway. I mean, everyone was drinking the stuff. Even Wico got into it.
Way's always into it.
Yeah,
he's every single time you see him, he's
a big ambassador for it. Yeah.
So is that a hipster drink? Is this to go with your hipster beard, Michael?
Oh, I don't know if it's a hipster. It's more hipster than just like straight whiskey. But it's I don't know if it's a hipster drink.
Yeah, I think it is. I think you'd classify that as hipster.
Actually, it probably is. I can't think of anything more hipster at the moment. So it probably is.
Okay, well, we've got one out of three hipsters on here, so we're right.
And I'm also consuming some painkillers as well for my back. So
what happened to your back? I was bending over the bench.
I woke up yesterday morning and it felt like someone had used my butt cheeks as boxing bags. Pains in my butt. Yep. And then during the day it started.
Calm down, Alex.
During the day it started traveling. The pain started traveling down my leg. And next thing you know, on the couch, trying to get some painkillers into me. So it happened to me a couple of years ago, and a bit of nerve damage, so a bulging disc. But
dodgy seat at your bench.
Just sitting doing watchmaking all the time, and then if you go out and do some manual labor, like at the moment I'm building steps and a retaining wall and stuff. It's just a combination.
You haven't finished those steps yet. Jeez, no. You've been doing that for a couple of days now. What's going on? You sent me a picture the other day. They were done.
I know, and that's it so far.
Okay.
But no, I've had to be lying around for the last couple of days, which is fine. I'm consuming podcasts, reading, taking painkillers, drink every now and then.
Negronis, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's
recording,
it's
podcasts.
It's been a good weekend. So,
listening, yeah. Recording. Okay.
Yep.
Good. Yeah, you messaged me pretty early this morning. Yeah. Just out of the blue, I'm high as a kite or something like that. And I was like, oh, good morning to you as well, Michael.
Yeah, exactly. I'm flying.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. I was like, oh, God, excellent. Well, that's a good way for someone to reach out to you on a Saturday morning. I was like, God damn it, he's having a better weekend than me already. This is not fair.
And then I was like, are you guys recording?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll ask Rob.
Anyway, we are. This is it. We're recording.
We're always available for
pretty much
recording.
Yeah.
What are you drinking, Rob? What have you got?
I thought you'd never ask. I'm taking a leaf out of my brother-in-law's book on a good mate in Switzerland. We had a raclette for dinner. You know a raclette, Michael? You know, like cheese raclette.
Yep. Love it.
Broke it out, had it with the kids and stuff. It was lumped heaps of cheese and, you know, hot fatty cheese, and then with a nice bottle of white wine. What are you laughing at? Oh, you're blowing your nose, my Alexander. What? Alexander.
Not me. He's talking to me like my mum.
Yeah.
Call me Alexander. I was trying to guzzle down some of this red wine. you can tell if I'm laughing.
You're cracking the next one
out my nose.
You're trying to catch up with me.
Yeah.
I got no hope. But I did get through a bottle of white with dinner. But then my brother-in-law always used to go, we'd have a fondue or a raclette or whatever, then we'd sit around, and then he'd crack a cold beer after to wash it all, you know, just to wash it down and something
that's
refreshing.
Good.
Well, you can't really drink cold water after it. You often get thirsty. It's quite salty cheese. But beer is fine. Seriously, it's good.
Anyway. I never drank it. Well, I was always told if you drink cold beer, anything cold after fondue or raclette, then you're in some trouble.
It's not too bad. Seriously, right. I mean, you got to have a pretty fragile metabolism. I mean, Alex wouldn't be able to, but you'd be able to do it and get away
with
it.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, I'd be recording from the toilet right now, probably.
No, as long as it's alcoholic. I mean, you can't have, yeah, obviously, cold water is no good, but this is fine. And it's I found a new beer, a little Kiwi beer called Wakachangi, and it's brilliant. No laugh. Well,
really any chance to put in some kind of funky pronunciation of something? You can't just have a Castle Mine 4X, could you?
No. This is brilliant.
Wakachangi.
That's exactly. I've watched it. A couple of ads on YouTube, and this their big byline is quite nice beer. It's one of those things where their marketing is just hilarious. and it's look it up, Wakachangi. There's some ads done by a Kiwi guy, a really funny TV presenter. They do a breakfast show, which is hilarious. And he does ads for these guys. Wakachangi. Brilliant. Uncle Kenny's amazing Wakachangi. Anyway, it's going down a treat, I must say.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, Charles just messaged me.
Oh, did he?
Okay. Yeah, we're still friends. It's all good.
Tell me in the middle of a podcast. Come back.
So it was you. Many thanks.
What did you? Because did you actually tell him to get stuffed about the Jedli pick?
No, I didn't. I didn't actually do that because I'm not that rude. But I said, I was just listening to the podcast and laughing because you tried to mention Jedli, and I already had.
So. Then he gave us another good one though. So,
I was messaging the guy today, the manifesto. Online.
I was hoping you would actually. We need to, get him on here.
Yeah.
Okay, what are we wearing on our wrists, gentlemen? Do I pick Gabby? You go first, Alex. No, yeah, okay. Yeah, you go.
So I was recording with Scottish Watches last night and I had two Speedmasters on.
Name dropper.
But tonight, because I'm feeling a bit more relaxed, I'm back to the old Swatch skin again, Swatch, I'm afraid, guys.
The one with the Milanese bracelet, at least?
No. A beautiful thin silicone
mm-hmm.
strap. Yeah,
very good. And how are the boys at Scottish Watches anyway?
They're good. There was no drinks to be had. Seriously? Well, I had a few drinks, but they didn't have anything to drink, which it makes you feel. Yeah, I did have a go at them. Mm. I said, like, you're well you putting our country to shame by not actually drinking. And I'm constantly telling everyone how we're a great nation of proud alcoholics, and they don't really drink on it. But yeah, they're good fun.
Good. Okay. Marco, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a Panerai.
Oh, you're wearing that Panerai with that beautiful beautiful blue strap.
Beautiful strap I got from you. Yeah.
What's Panerai, the model again?
Panerai Luminor. I couldn't tell you the reference. I should have looked at it. Oh, God.
That is poor.
I know. It's my wife's Panerai. This is actually her Panerai. Yeah, so this one I bought in Italy in 2012. We were hoping to go for a trip to Europe together, and we ended up getting pregnant. And so my brother came along with me instead, and we went to Prague.
Wait a minute. Yeah, so your wife got pregnant.
hold on.
You left her.
No. We were planning it. We didn't actually get the tickets or anything, but we were sort of saying we should do this. And she sort of, when we got pregnant, she sort of said, look, you should go off and go to Europe anyway. So I was like, okay.
That's what you call a test, Michael.
She's a pretty cool wife, eh? So
that's very cool. I mean,
yeah.
So you went on holiday and you bought a watch.
We went to Prague. We went to Zurich. We went to Paris. Rome.
Can I ask? Did you Basel, buy at the old shop, the old Panerai shop in Florence?
No.
Okay.
I bought it from a secondhand dealer in Rome. And I thought because she can't come on the holiday, I'm going to get her a gift and take it back.
Beautiful.
To her. And
a gift that you can also wear, right?
Yeah, exactly. And she,
did she ask for a Panerai? I'm guessing no.
You know what? Before that trip, she always liked the look of Panerai, and she used to wear one of my Daytonas years ago, and I sold that one. So I thought I felt guilty about that. She was actually wearing that. That was a favorite watch, but I bought her this and.
And now you're wearing that. Okay.
And now I'm wearing that. I wear it more than she does, but she still loves it.
Maybe it was just a strange craving, like a pregnancy craving for a Panerai. That was it.
Like gummy bears and Panerai.
Yeah.
No, but it's a beautiful strap on this thing. Rob's
another strap. Yep.
Geneva Blue. Yep, exactly.
Great. This is brilliant.
This strap could last longer than the watch.
You did say that before we came on. You said it feels like it could last 200 years.
200 years. This strap is really rare. Yep.
Is that because it's made of asbestos? Or no? It's at least 10% asbestos. Rob guarantees all his straps are at least 10% asbestos,
minimum,
right, Rob?
Minimum. Yep. Goodness me. What are we up to?
What have you got on?
I'm wearing a little a Tudor, just for a change. It's
nice.
One I haven't got out for a long time. Probably haven't worn it for a year. It's a Prince Oyster Date from about the mid to late 60s, I suppose. It's a tight, the smaller size, 34mm type thing. Just a grey dial. It's a little small rose dial. And it's an old guy, a very old man, a friend of the family who gave it to us. And he died since. He died quite quickly afterwards. He had cancer or something. Actually gave it to me for my son, my 11-year-old son, who's 11 at the moment. He was 10 or 9 or 10 then. And he said, this is for your boy. And I said, are you serious? And yeah. He wanted to give it away. So I'm sort of looking after it for him. He's too rough to wear it for the moment. But it's just a cool old watch, really. You know what it's like wearing these old vintage ones. They're quite small these days, you know. But it's a cool watch. I like it. It's got the old rotor self winding thing on the dial and stuff. And it's basic little watch. Actually, I've got it on a bright blue strap, which is a bit over the top really for it. But
is it one of your straps?
No, I don't have any this size yet. I will have.
That's how much kind of faith you have in your own product.
No, I don't have this size yet, Drongo.
Because what sizes do you have? You have 18, 20, 22, not, 24.
Not yet. I don't have 18 yet. I have 20. This is great. I get to talk about my straps. Yeah. 20, 22, and 24 for the moment.
Right.
But I will have 18, 19, 20, 21 coming.
Well, so they cover Panerai, Speedmasters, exactly. Rolex, most Rolex. Yeah, yes. So they're good.
Yep. Not the first Omega in space, though.
Really?
Yeah, because that's 19 mil.
Well, that's what's coming out. Remember? That's what's going to get in a few weeks' time. So just hold your horses.
I didn't realize that was smaller.
Yeah, 19. Yeah,
a bit of a funny one.
There we go. There's my learning for the day.
Yeah. Just need to just work out what Panerai you've got on now as well, and then you're ready for everything.
What was that?
You just need to work out what the reference number on your Panerai is now.
Oh, I can get my loop out and have a look.
You need your loop on all the time.
Yeah, I have your loop on. I got my loop on. Not really, actually.
I've got my white coat on.
And that's all. Nothing underneath.
It's limited to 1,500 pieces.
Ooh.
It's number 256 of 1,500.
Wow. 1,500. Okay. That's a tiny limited edition, isn't it?
And it's OP. It's one of the original ones with the ETA, the big ETA movement.
Oh, really? The manual?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm in a dark room at the moment, so it's OP6. Oh, man, let's get the torch out. OP6568.
Oh, the 6568.
Yep.
Never heard of it. Okay.
Yep. That's not a Panerai reference. It's not always like PAM 35.
Oh, yeah, but they never, yeah. Well, they don't have the PAM number on this. I never understood why they have a PAM reference and then they have another reference, OP.
Me either.
What are they doing?
Anybody from Panerai who's listening in to the podcast, can you please sort that out?
Yep. DM me.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, moving right along. We can wrap up now, can't we, pretty much?
Yeah.
We
done? 20 minutes. We're good.
Yeah, so, you know, we've got three watchmakers on this now.
Oh, you're joking. Well, 2.5.
No, remember, I only ever classify myself as half a watchmaker.
That's not true.
Rob is 90% of a watchmaker. You were at 100%, but if you don't know your watch references, I might have to downgrade you as well to 95. I'll give you 95 out of 100. Yeah.
That's not true, though, man. How many years have you been watchmaking?
Me?
Yeah.
Three.
You see, you've got a long way to go, and you got a lot to learn, but you still, that's just what happens in watchmaking. You can't.
Listen, I gave up learning a long time ago.
He's teaching now.
Oh, God. Yeah. Anyone who I'm teaching is in serious. Although I have trained people before. I don't want to say.
To do what?
I feel like this is the part where I say this is definitely not the way things happen at Swatch. But some people say that it's you come in, the last person who joined trains you, even though if they've only started a week before you.
It's their job.
And then it just kind of goes on from there and there, on and on and on, until everyone's incredibly undereducated when it comes to Swatch making. Now, that's not what happens at Swatch, but I've heard Swatch making, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yep. Man, you take some risks, don't you?
I really do.
You love it. You love living on the edge.
Well, I think Michael's probably the one that is what classifies as the most experienced watchmaker here.
I don't know about that. Well, I mean, after listening to that first podcast with you, that episode, which was amazing. That waffling on went for a long time, but it was there was a lot of good info in there, and I was actually, well, I don't know about info, but it was a good I could paint a good picture of your experience.
That's good. I'm glad, actually.
Yeah, I think going through AP and learning Anglage and so that's definitely interesting. Really good.
Ah, here we go. Anglage again. You're going to get started.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, you mentioned it. I'm glad you mentioned that because
I love talking about Anglage.
I've been dreaming up. I was thinking the other night. I'm going to do. You see my YouTube things. My little tiny dodgy clips on YouTube.
I was going to say I've been meaning to look at your YouTube video. I was going to prepare for
out.
I didn't even watch the one we were both on. Jesus,
we did one. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we were both on. We did a
test. You're supposed to be the super fan, Michael. I thought you were the super fan. Yeah.
And downgraded again. There's so much content to consume at the moment with all of Waco's videos out at the moment on YouTube and everything. It's mental. I have to stay up 24 hours a day just to get through everything.
Fair enough. I wouldn't look at ours either, actually. Mine either, to be honest.
But, no, I'm going to, because
I'm about to do it in French. So you can listen to it in French, then I want to do the...
Oh, God.
Really? You should.
No, please don't.
Well, no, it's not for you, Alex. You just sit back over in the corner, okay?
I'm the only person that watches the bloody YouTube videos. You need to encourage me.
No, there's three or four others. There's at least three others.
I think it'd be cool if you did it in French.
Well, no, hang on.
Alex is there as well, because he just start laughing all the time.
Let me explain. Well, yeah, true. There's guys in Switzerland that want to listen to or watch them, but they get, you know, 2 minutes in and they sort of eyes glaze over and they can't. I talked to a couple of ex-colleagues, and one ex-colleague, he said, "Oh, I would love to, but I can't understand the English, mate." And I, you know, well, this is what he says in French, obviously. But so, you know, so I thought, "Oh well, I'll sort you out. I'll do a French one just to." But it won't be as long as that 2 hour marathon I do. I'll split it up. But yeah, we'll chuck that on YouTube and see if it gets any. You know, see if the old Swissies get involved.
But that one was the most popular one. That one, I know I said this before, but that one, that was the most popular. Well, in terms of people making it all the way through to the end,
yeah.
That was the most popular one.
I can see why as well.
We don't want to dwell on that, but no. I was actually, I met last time I was in Melbourne. I met Michael Presser. I went up to his great little workshop, by the way. He's got there.
He has.
Seemed like a nice guy.
He's a great guy.
Knows his stuff, and I had a really, really a decent long chat with him. We're talking about Patek and AP, after-sales service, and different stuff. He showed me around. It was quite educational. And but I've not met Paul. I've heard so. Paul Madden is the guy you work with as well, right? And he's the one in WASTAP. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, he was my teacher at. Yeah, I worked with him, and then he was my teacher at WASTAP. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. So obviously he knows his stuff as well. How long has he been at WASTAP for now?
Well, he's just gone back there recently in the last couple of years. He started at WASTAP and then he traveled. He was in China. He was in the US as an instructor, and he's come back around to Switzerland. But I think he'd be great to have on the podcast too.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't like these people that have been places. All these people have been in Switzerland, Hong Kong, and I'm like, I've been in Glen Iris. And the train and the tram to and from Glen Iris.
But don't you understand? You get to travel through these people, and you don't have to spend any money on it. You get to experience all this traveling.
I want to go and eat the cheeses and get the crippling diarrhea from having the wrong beverage afterwards. Like,
I'll have a chat to JCB and I'll try and hook you up with some cheese.
We'll sort you out. They're going to come over next year, basically. I deliberately didn't say that I'd met Charles in Hong Kong because I knew you'd go off on a tangent, basically, when I first met him. But it was anyway.
Which Charles?
Charles Turl.
Oh, okay, Charles Turl.
You visited Michael Presser.
But it was just sort of, and I guess I know. Oh no! Shout out to Tom Ashton, another one of your ex-colleagues at Rolex. Ex-Rolex.
Yes,
he's gone too now.
Keep
up with him. He came across on a course. When I was in Geneva, and I think it was Yia or someone hooked us up or told him to get in touch with me, basically. So this guy out of the blue, you know, from Melbourne, calls me and says, "Oh, I'm in town for a course." Said, yeah, great. So we caught up, had dinner and stuff. I showed him around. And I think there was something on. It was the Vendange or something, which is like an evening where all the watch shops are open to public,
right?
And they have wine. They have a different wine per every different boutique, a different vigneron. It's great. You just get, well, you have a bit of wine, and wander around looking at watches. It's in Geneva.
Count
down.
Me in.
That's
can
brilliant.
I just, it's, can it's I just wonderful. Say? Can I just say I love the way you say boutique.
Jesus
Christ.
Okay.
Don't say that anymore.
Boutique.
Well, I'm just sorry.
I can't
Alex
do it.
Gets cheesed off.
You know, the one I love the most is when go. Rob tries to say a number and then he's like, listen, I apologize. I can only think of numbers now in French.
I've never
I have
said
to
that in
translate
my life.
Them. I have to say them out loud in French and then translate them back into English and then into Australian.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
And it's not even true, but it would be incredible. But there's just one or two instances where, you know, it's off the top of your head, a model or a movement reference pops into your head in French. But I mean, because you do your training on it, you do 3 or 4 or 5 years in it, talking about this thing in the 6497 French. I can say it now. I can say it in English. The ETA, yeah, the Valjoux 6497. I can say it. It took me a few years to get to that. Anyway, yeah. I won't say it in French because he gets pissed off. But anyway.
Sorry, I keep changing direction.
That's good. It's good for us.
There is no direction you can't change a direction from no direction. Okay.
You were just talking about my friend and ex-colleague Tom Ashton.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he just came. I was saying he came over for a course, and we caught up, and we took him out to dinner, had a little cool little restaurant in the old town that you'd been up in, the Vieille-Ville, Geneva. And then the next day, I think, was this, just happened to be the Vendange, this little, it's a big event, actually. But it's really local. It's the sort of thing they don't even hear about outside Geneva because, you know, you have the big shows, of course, that everyone hears of, but there's lots of little things, you know what it's like, stuff in Neuchâtel even, the stuff that happens and you don't even hear about it outside of. And this Vendange thing is I don't know if they still do it. I'm pretty sure they would. We did it for several years. And so you're just rocking in and, you know, Geneva's a small town, as you know, you run up and down Rue de Rhône and, you know all most of the boutique managers because they're all, you know, the same sort of job and they all love Richard Mille, so you just rock it anywhere. So you go in there and grab a glass of wine at every different boutique, and it's like, my goodness, by the end it's quite a struggle. Tom actually he piked out, I didn't, not halfway, but we got a fair bit of it done, two thirds, and then he had to go. I think he was leaving early the next morning, so I didn't want to get too carried away, but we did the pâté, the salon pâté, and a few different spots, some of the ones he wanted to see, so it was just really cool. And you know, I can imagine for a guy, I mean, sure, he'd probably been to Geneva before for a course once or twice, but you know, to come from Melbourne to go there and to really experience something quite different was quite cool to be able to, you know, share that. So yeah.
What year was that?
Testing me now. I could look it up. It was between 2010 and 2015. Yeah.
Yeah. So he would have probably gone for the last date eight course on the 32.55 then. Oh, because I was
the old 32.55. Yeah.
It's the newest caliber.
Yeah, he would have told me, but I forgot straight away. I don't know all the references, basically. But yeah, it was kind of cool to be. I guess Rolex seemed quite good like that to do with the training and stuff, and they're quite thorough. Yeah. Okay. So that's all the old guards left then. They've got a new bunch of young guys there, or what's the story?
They have. No, not all of them, because there's still a couple of the original guys there that when I first started in 2005, they're still there.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Because Tom seemed he's quite not. He'd been there a little while.
I want to say he started there in maybe it was 2009.
Okay. I actually had a little.
Sorry, Tom, if I'm wrong, but yeah, I remember because he didn't come to my wedding, and my wedding was in 2009. I think I'd already sent out invites to all of the other work colleagues, and he was one of the guys that didn't come to the wedding.
Right. Okay.
Sorry, man.
Poor Tom.
You know.
Did you go to the wedding, Michael, or did you go on a Europe trip with your brother?
Yeah, no, I turned up to the wedding.
good stuff. Yeah,
yeah, it was the best.
Be there for the important days.
We had a whole weekend, and it was like a record amount of watchmakers at a wedding.
Serious,
it was like all of the Rolex team, and then all of my family, and yeah, it was
you just talked watches all weekend.
Well, no, not really, because it got to be crazy, but it was a lot of fun.
I actually had a job. I almost got Tom to do something for me during the Australian Open because Nadal had a problem with his Richard Mille. There's like a screw missing or something that came out of a screen or something rather. And we were running around panicking. And my boss, the director of Richard Mille, the AP actually in Switzerland, said, you know any watchmakers in Melbourne? I said, yeah, sure, of course I do. And he's like, well, what do you mean? I said, oh, no, I know watchmakers in every single major city of the world. Anyway, I said, this is the guy. Tom's a great guy, works for Rolex. He'll do it, no worries. We've got to send him some screws. He can go. He can go and pick up the watch from the Australian Open, fix the thing, put it in. Yeah, and it was all sorted. We're going to do it. And then in the last second, there was another alternative or someone handed him another watch or something. So poor Tom missed out on a free trip. It would have been sort of outside and extracurricular to Rolex. But anyway, no one would have known until afterwards.
Until now.
Exactly.
do you pronounce it Richard Mill? Isn't it Richard Mill?
Richard, over there you'd pronounce it Richard Mill. Yeah.
Right, okay.
If I say that here, no one knows what I'm talking about, so I've got to sort of
modify
it a bit.
Well, it's not that different.
Krisha. Yeah, you wouldn't say that. Yeah, anyway.
You could just go halfway and go Richard Mill.
Nah. Well, look, if you look at my YouTube videos where I pronounce all Swiss watchmaking company names in French,
then you're not up to date, Michael. Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah,
he does. It's been all through them all.
What am I up to? No, I haven't quite been through them all. I'm up to the last.
It feels like you've been through them all. It feels like you've been through them all many, many, many
times. Could you just not listen anymore? Okay, you can just turn off now. And I'll finish off. I've only got a couple of letters left, and then I'll start on something else.
I have to get on your YouTube channel.
Oh dear. No, well, yeah, you might. If you get through the first one, let me know, and then it's already a big effort.
Well, I got through your podcast, the first episode, so I listened to that in one night.
Oh, crikey. 2 hours. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I never just. Oh my goodness. Okay.
Even we had to take a break halfway in.
More than a break. You had to go and have a pee, didn't you?
Yeah.
That's what you meant. Okay.
What listeners don't know, but my podcast with Anthony and Alex, I kept it running and I went to the toilet.
They're gonna know now.
Yeah. Well, they do know now. But I actually
I was impressed by that when you told me afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah, it was around the point where Anthony was asking me about Rolex and the second hand market basically, and I think at that point I said I don't know how to answer that because I was concentrating. I really just wanted them to talk between themselves and just leave me alone for give me 20 seconds. But I managed to get through it.
One thing I did pick up from that conversation, just harking back to that, was the bit you were talking about how Rolex don't want to work on certain, you know, watches that are over a certain age or certain, you know, delicate dials or whatever old watches. You're just talking about, can I just clarify, you're talking about Rolex Australia there. I mean, if a guy took it back to Geneva and said, you know, do the service.
Well, if you or took not, it I don't to know. The... it's a good question. If it may have to go to the restoration department, depending on the age or the rarity of the dial, or maybe Rolex Geneva direct, just the regular after sales service might handle that. I'm not 100% sure about that because I've been out of Rolex for a few years now and it was changing a little bit, but I know before Rolex Australia, even there was affiliates around the world for years, not working on any Newmans or any dials that had anything unusual on it. They were just
it doesn't kind of sound logical. I mean, it's their product and they're still there and it's an old company and they should have spares and everything else. You'd imagine that they wouldn't, you know, really be able to say no to a service on an old piece. I don't know.
Well, they probably
AP and these places where they've got big that. Or they call them departments. You mentioned the word before, departments where they redo the whole, you know,
historic restoration. That's restoration. What Omega have got, yeah.
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 You know, they do it. That's their job. They do their best and there's waivers and all sorts of things, but I'd imagine Rolex would do the similar thing now in Geneva.
Yeah, I think they've got a restoration department and I spent a week there with them and they would probably handle anything actually, those guys. Yeah, okay. So
are they any good though? Because I always tell people to not send stuff, any vintage stuff. I always tell people not to send it to the original manufacturers because they're not. I just don't think they're set up for it.
Some of them.
There's, well, the ones that I know about. I wouldn't risk it. I'd rather send it to somebody who just does vintage, whatever the brand is, and have more faith in them actually doing it properly because that's the stuff they always do.
Yes.
Right. I've heard too many horror stories and seen too many watches come back that look like they're half new, half old. So I wouldn't even risk it, especially when some of the brands kind of shy away from doing work on the older pieces. I just think like why bother even giving them the chance to fuck it up in the first place? Just send it to someone who knows what they're doing.
I know
the guys at Rolex in Melbourne at least, and I trust them. But they wouldn't probably work on something that's super rare, that's got a dial that's like it's got King Vizil's dial signature on the dial or something like that. They'd just say no, we're not gonna risk that. So
yeah, okay.
But they always offer options. So It depends on the watchmaker too. I mean, it's hard to know with independent watchmakers who's good to send that sort of stuff to as well.
Yeah.
So,
were you there still when Dufour, the CEO, was there, or was it after he was?
No, I was. I'm pretty sure I was there, and I didn't meet him.
When did he come?
It must have been like 2016 or 17.
Yeah, around there. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a clever guy. He seems like a switched on guy.
Yeah. I didn't meet him because he had a flying visit, I think, and
yeah, okay.
And I think it was over a weekend or something. But
I think I met him at Zenith or something once. A while ago. I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't remember who I was, but when he was at Zenith. There's some clever guys in the industry in Switzerland. My goodness, they are really some smart cookies. He's one of the best CEOs, I reckon. Well, that's obviously where he got the headhunted for those guys. But
yeah. So what was your experience at Richard Mille again?
Have we got time, Alex?
Of course we do. We've got all the time in the world. This is.
I worked well. The Richard Mille. I say Richard Mille to the Aussies, but the Richard Mille, la boutique Richard Mille, à Genève.
That sounds so much better.
It was a joint venture. it was a joint venture between Richard Mille EMEA, EMEA, which is Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and that's like the distributor, and Audemars Piguet Swiss, which is not Audemars Piguet Le Brassu, but Audemars Piguet the Swiss affiliate, where I worked momentarily off for almost a couple of years between when I worked at the manufacturer and then I worked at the Swiss affiliate. And then they had this project and they just opened. They'd had a soft opening for the new Richard Mille boutique in Geneva. And then all of a sudden they needed someone to run it, basically.
That's cool.
And yeah, they wanted someone with, English and French, and also sort of ideally watchmaking plus sales. And it's kind of a weird profile. Yeah. Not many people luckily had that. And I'd done sales before getting into watchmaking. Before starting with AP, I'd done international sales for a tooling company, in French and English and whatever, based in Switzerland. Mm. So it sort of worked out and I put my hand up and said, pick me. And they did. Stupid.
I think you must have been perfect for the job because you can certainly talk as well. So
that's about all I can do, really, to be honest. And so I was there. Yeah, we sort of did a proper opening then, and that was the first Richard Mille boutique, really. I think, well, not in Europe, but well, definitely in Switzerland, and then just was in the high growth phase. Was great, everything was going nuts. And then when I left, they were redoing the whole thing, changing the strategy, redoing the boutique, and then opening a new big boutique in the center of Geneva, in the Rue de Horn. So that was the mass. Now that became the flagship boutique. The other one, actually, we renovated it and sort of closed it for a while, and that's when I actually left. And then they reopened it, and then they shut it down and converted it back into an AP boutique, well, a multi-mark AP boutique. So it's not even Richard Mille anymore. We had Richard Mille in that boutique. And then they took it back basically for the main shop in town.
Yeah.
So for 5 years I ran that shop. And at the start, see, they wanted, we actually had a little, a bench, a workbench. But it was all, stainless steel and frosted glass, and it looked great, but it was terrible to work at.
Not practical. Yeah.
No, not practical. But then we had a big plate glass window going out to quite close to the lobby of the hotel, the Kempinski, and then another one looking out basically to the, I don't know what you call it in English. Sorry, Alex. I don't even know what to call it in French. where they had all the cars to come in for the concierge and stuff for the hotel. So all these really fancy cars would rock up and park outside, just outside the boutique. Was cool. Rolls and Aston 170s, 177s and stuff like that. It was just nuts. So it morphed really quickly from a watchmaker you know, in inverted commas, watchmaker, sales guy, responsible for the boutique to just managing the shop. I still had the bench there for the freaking whatever you call it to do, you know, strap changes and basic stuff. Yeah, go open a watch and it has a loose screw, whatever. I didn't do any full servicing. I had a few little bits and pieces, but you know, the longer I was there, the more I had. I sort of doing more and more, but I never did any real proper servicing.
Yeah,
we just get, but I went up to Le Brûlé quite often, where the factory was or is, which is between sort of it's the other side of La Chaux-de-Fonds. If you go quite north of Chaux-de-Fonds, basically towards the French border, again between La Chaux-de-Fonds and Saint-Léger or Basel, that direction. That's where the watches are made, and I went up there a bit for the courses, like you guys did, you know, back to the mothership. So I had a decent, yeah, good experience. Yeah, I mean, could, you know, was uncasing and casing up and all that sort of stuff, was no drama. But I didn't really do any. I didn't have enough room or plate, I mean, you know, parts or anything to do anything in the boutique anyway. So,
could you service one if you needed to though? Now, if you were given one just now, could you service it?
It's a Vorschen movement. It's nothing that special.
They look spectacular, but it's a
pretty basic movement. I mean, the concept is like any other, as you know, you know, the gear train is nothing. It's just that it's all skeletonized, so it looks kind of cool. But you know, I've seen that movement non-skeletonized, used in a, you know, Hermes or Chopard or whatever. Well, not Chopard, but Chanel. There's a few different brands that use that very similar movement, and non-skeletonized. And it was the only thing I'd hesitate these days to do a hairspring. I haven't really. I mean, I could have a stab at it, but it'd be literally a stab. but yeah, I mean, it's no drama, right? And that's what I found at AP. It was, you know, people can see straight away, and you do bench tests and stuff. So, you know, you've got decent hands and good eyes, you know, it's not rocket science, but,
How are they skeletonizing the, Richard Mille movements? Can you talk about that? All machine done, is it? And then is it hand finished afterwards?
It's not even really hand finished, to be honest. Some parts are, but the main movement, the main bridges and stuff, I mean, it's all just, skeletonized, just machine. It's all just, you know, CNC skeletonized. There's nothing that flash. There's no hand polishing. There is a little bit on some limited tourbillons. Edition, you know, some tourbillons.
Yeah.
But the base model, the RM, well, the 10s and 11s back in the day are still 11s, and then the 29, 30, that sort of stuff. The basic, you know, time and date. The movements are really nothing over the top as far as finishing. I mean, the finishing looked good.
Is it just kind of mass produced then? Is that what you're saying?
As mass produced as you can have in a for 2,000 movements. Yeah, I mean, they're not making any more than about 4,000. So
where's all the hidden value? How do they imagine up the price tag on them there?
Mate, Rafa Nadal wears it, mate.
You just said one of the screws fell out when he was hitting a shoddy backhand. So, like,
that's because he always wore prototypes. That's our excuse.
Ah, okay.
There's always prototypes.
But is there any kind of direct connection?
Well, I mean, yeah, he wore a lot of the prototypes. The very first RM27s, for example. They kept flying off because they couldn't hold it under his backhand was, or his forehand, whatever, his smash was too hard. There's too many G's, and that's what happened. Effectively, the screws holding the bracelet on, or the strap, the Velcro strap onto the watch, the carbon watch, was not strong enough, or the fittings weren't strong enough at the end of the bracelet. The bracelet kept the bit in the middle of the nylon part in the middle of the bracelet kept coming loose or whatever, and there's two or three of them flew off his wrist back at the start. And they got this $750,000 watch flying around the court, but they fixed that, and that was all part. You know, it's part of the development. It was a full on proper development. You know, and apart from that, they worked with other brands, but that was the high end. The bread and butter was the basic models, which were the Vorschen movement. Beautiful, beautifully done Vorschen movement, but it's still a Vorschen. But yeah, it was you know, they were pretty simple. Well, no, they weren't simple. I mean, compared to some watches, they weren't simple, but no. You know, the principle doesn't change much.
They still look really nice. I mean, the way they're done and the casing and everything.
Yeah. I always have a soft spot for them. I go, obviously, logically. Yeah. But, I mean, some people hate them or don't like them at all. You know, you read people that just don't see the value. But, yeah, I can see it. I mean, they do have a different look. I think it's just clever. Richard, you know, Richard, he was such a clever marketing guy. great, really nice guy, funny guy, good guy. And, he's just really, really clever at marketing. And that's the brands sometimes that do best. It's the guys that aren't watchmakers. They don't get bogged down in technical stuff. They surround themselves with good people. And I've said almost every time I talk about this, I talk about Max Busser in the same breath, because he's the same. He's not a watchmaker. He's a marketing guru, you know.
I like how he doesn't there's nothing fake about it either. He talks about using other people to help him build the watches.
Yep.
Yeah, and he uses great stuff. Watchmakers to help him.
Brilliant watchmakers. Yeah. And his whole team, the different team, which is a sort of an evolving, a moving team all the time, depending on the project. You know, they're all brilliant guys, and some of them, well, you know, some of them, they're great guys.
Steve McDonald for the perpetual calendar. He was a teacher when I was at WOSTEF, actually.
I've not met him. I think I've seen him. I've seen him around, but I've not actually. I don't think I've ever actually spoken to him. Unfortunately, I mean, nice I know guy. He's worked with. Yeah, apparently
from Ireland too.
Yep, another one, another Paddy.
Yep.
he's worked with Carey. He's worked with François Monjon. He's worked with a bunch of, and also that the design dude, my mate. What's his name? He just really gets good people, basically, that are the best in their field, and that's why they end up being, you know, really cool, really cool watches.
Is that not what he did when he was with Harry Winston anyway, doing the whole Opus thing? Mm-hmm. He was just kind of picking the right people to do
managing the project
to basically. Do the job, and then he took that kind of idea and then started up his own thing. So it's basically a extension of the Opus series, but in his own in his own vision, which has worked out for him really well.
That had already used, you know, André Streller and these guys, these other watchmakers that had worked on that, the Uwek guys. You know, he had a lot of contacts with all these guys already. So he just took that over to his own structure, and it was worked brilliantly, basically. Not always the easiest watches to work on, I think. I knew new guys, different watchmakers and different contractors here and there who worked on the stuff for him and with him and stuff, and they weren't always easy, but they're easier than the Harry Winston ones. A few of them were just
crazy
to work on. They could never get right. The prototypes were for years and years and years. But then again, you know, Richard Mill went through that as well. We had a few Richard Mills which took years to come to market because we just couldn't get the things right, and the marketing guys would pop out with it and show images of it, and all of a sudden they're working their butts off to try and release it to market, but it took years sometimes.
It's a lot of risk and work involved in creating something so different. Like, it's similar to Vianney Alta, his watches. They're so different, and I know they were rushing at some point to get ready for Baselworld, you know, each year. So
yeah, and that's why he almost chucked it in. Vianney, he's a funny guy as well, but he got really quite frustrating, and then he had problems with service and stuff, and you know, when you start having customers that complain and stuff, not that he had that many, but there was just a few issues for a few years, and then he was so close to saying, forget it, I'm not going to do it. And he did have a little bit of a break for a couple of years. Do you know Vianney, Michael?
I've never met him. I know someone that worked for him.
I've been in the workshop a few times. He's probably the closest watchmaker to my house though, in Switzerland. I don't know. Anyway, he's got the awesomest workshop, but it's pretty much like our podcast, just no structure. No, it's all over the place. There's no, it's just a nightmare. It's a shit muzzle.
I'm going to get my CV ready and just send it. And I'm like, I'm overqualified to work for you. Please listen to the podcast.
Exactly. Oh, you'll be like Flynn. But great guy, really funny guy and really good. But yeah, I mean, you know, a genius with stuff he comes out with. And that last one, that really, the deep space really got him back on the road to redemption, you know, even in his own mind, he really, really got him back interested again, passionate about it. Got a few people that were all, you know, opened people's eyes, got some buyers, and that really kicked him off again, really. So it's because he made some great stuff back in the day, but he's just, these guys need, you know, they need to be driven. And you have a project like that, he's
great he does guy. Some amazing stuff. I mean, he's a incredible stuff.
I suppose if you're making crazy stuff and there's going to be teething issues with these kind of things, of course, if you're making again small production runs, it's not like the big guys who can just pump out a million and then sort them out as they go. And if your customers are spending multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars on a watch, they're probably going to be a lot more vocal about it if they're not happy.
Oh, for sure.
Compared to someone that spends $1,000 on something. So that's when it really has to be a true kind of labor of love that they're involved in. They can't really go in kind of with a half measure. They need to be fully into it to make it a successful thing.
Oh, yeah. You look at the classic, is it Janvier? Classic Janvier. Bianchi's watch.
Yep.
That's an incredible masterpiece. Yeah, to make one of those, he has to basically put aside 12 months or something like that. He has to say, I'm not doing any other work. He hand makes the dial, like hand engraves the numerals and everything. It's incredible. And the workmanship and the movement is just insane.
Yeah. But then at least those guys, they're a bit more flexible. You know, they can spend a year doing it, or they can stop other projects and stuff. Whereas the big guys with their, you know, their production schedules and all their stuff, and their suppliers and everything, it's a lot more planning involved. Well, then the small guys are too, but they are more flexible. They can move quickly. They can change a part. They can change something. And if it works, sometimes they can get away with it. But stuff like Fiani's is next level. It's nuts.
It is.
But he's a great guy as well. That's what I like about the watchmakers I got them best with were the ones who could go and have a drink with, or the ones that just didn't take themselves too seriously. And Vianney really doesn't. He's just so funny.
He'd be great to meet. He just seems like a lot of fun.
Yeah. He is.
I'll give you a call once I get a job with him, Michael. Yep. Okay, you can come and visit.
Do that.
In fact, I'll just send them this podcast as part of my CV. I'll just attach it as an audio file so he knows how disorganized I am.
And then tell him I sent you. He'll be right.
Yeah, it's a great workshop. Like, it is great. There's equipment everywhere. It's like, it's not like a typical workshop.
You went to the workshop, didn't you? That's right.
And clean and everything. He's got crazy machines just everywhere.
There's airplane parts and bits and pieces. It's like, it's just it's Aladdin's cave of stuff.
I did visit there one weekend, but he just...
That's right. There. Remember you mentioned... That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's probably out flying his plane or something, rather. He does that a bit sometimes. And that's some interesting characters. Oh, that's what I really like about the industry over there. Here as well, you know, there's some characters. But you were also saying, I'm just trying to think back, and we're talking about the Rolex thing again, getting back. We're going around in circles here, but anyway.
That's all right.
You were saying that, the training is quite different. You go and they're sort of having, they don't need proper watchmakers. It's sort of just service people. And is that pretty much run of the mill for Australian entities or brands here? I imagine.
I think it's like that worldwide.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's me. You mentioned it. Yeah. AP. Yeah. I mentioned to Alex once that they get more and more operator training. They still do the watchmakers thing. But in parallel now, which they never did do, they do the operators, which is the lesser skilled people, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's companies that are taking people that don't have watchmaking backgrounds, and they're training them for one operation in production or something like that, or after sales even. All right, you put in a few wheels in the gear train, and you put the bridge on, and that's it. And then someone else has been trained on another area. So there's so many different levels of watchmaking training and competence.
But see, the people that do that, they're never going to be able to build a passion for the industry. I don't think, like, I've met a few people that worked at the ETA factory and stuff, and they're just doing the same shit over and over and over and over again. And how can you build anything on that when the best you can hope for is to move into another position where you do something similar over and over and over and over again? It's just, I think it takes away any hope for the people actually fully embracing and getting into it properly.
Sure.
But you know, some people, it depends on how you're built and how you think. Some people thrive on jobs that are very monotonous, and they challenge themselves in different ways within that job. And they have no desire to go on and create anything or do something different and have to change their job every year or two. Some people are just, it's their job and they do it well and they go. I remember going through, I don't remember which factory it was, and there was a girl just working on hairsprings every day, spinning the balance and manipulating the hairspring just so it was flat and centered. And she got it down to a, like, I looked at that and I thought, there's no way I could get to that level. She was so good at adjusting a hairspring on a balance and no movement. She didn't touch anything in the movement. She just had a balance with a hairspring, spinning it, looking at it. And we were watching her just go through that, just thinking she was doing like
one
balance and hairspring in a minute or something and just kept going. And it was like so good at it. And she probably, within that job, she probably challenges herself every day. I'm not sure. Or maybe she was gone within 6 months because she got sick of it.
How much would you have to be paid, Michael, to do that job over and over again?
$1 million.
Exactly. Yeah, we have this discussion at work. Anytime we're doing something when it's like, okay, I've changed 12 batteries in a CK today, and we have this kind of like, what's the most fucked up situation you can kind of pick? And it's like, okay, you can either go and work on only 3-2-1 caliber Speedmasters for $10,000 a year, or you just do CK battery changes and you get paid $250,000 a year, and we all kind of challenge each other as like how bad does it have to be?
Yeah.
But that probably not the healthiest game to play when you're at work and actually doing those tasks, though.
It depends on the type of person you are, though. I mean, there's a lot of watchmakers that just thrive on doing something different all the time, and there's others that are just happy to go in, do the job, and go out. So.
I'd like to. We only sort of see it from, and you've seen it from the Rolex point of view and other workshops, but I've only always seen it from AP, Richard Mill to a degree. I don't even know how the Swatch Group or Omega in Bien would do it or to do their training. I don't know, they have different training programs and they're a big enough company to want to give something back and to put on apprentices, basically. But I don't know how the training's set up, whether they do any real heritage stuff, the proper, finishing and hand beveling, the onglage. And all that stuff, whether they do that or not. I know some Patek, that's for sure, and VC would, but I don't know, with the big brands that are more industrial, really, the bigger brands, whether they do that.
Didn't I message you guys the other day? I definitely messaged one of you to talk about some training that definitely wasn't at the company that I work for, but it was people that had been at the company for 2 or 3 years and were finally getting the introduction to the company training that you should get within the first week. And it's like an introduction to quartz and mechanical training to be able to do like your first week of the job. And now they're getting it 2 or 3 years into the, I mean, that's.
They're probably just desperate to get work done. It's like,
exactly.
Priorities. Watches fix.
Yeah. It's all about, these days, it's all about budget as well. And I think the saddest thing for me, I think, globally and generally speaking for watch brands, and I saw this probably, I don't know. When I started at AP, it was already starting coming quite heavily in some big brands, and AP was starting to do it in that before, 20, 30, 40 years ago, a repair center, a service center was not a profit center. It was almost like it was subsidized to provide a brilliant service. And I know we talked about this once, Alex, and I think actually Omega do a pretty good job, but there are brands who now everything's down to the accountants. Everything's down because, they're publicly listed companies. They're companies that want to make profits. And every single department in the company, including the service workshops, need to make a profit, which is a different mindset to what they used to be like when it was a service provided. And it wasn't as much a profit thing. Now it's just gone nuts and it's gone the other way where, every single screw, every single service. No, I'm not talking about Swatch Group necessarily, but there's hundreds of companies out there. They all do it differently. But some of them are quite like that, where it's, of course the customer's going to get fed up if he's paying a fortune for the service. It takes forever, and it's not necessarily the cost has gone nuts.
It's not the way it should be. It's not the way it should be.
It shouldn't be that.
After sales service should always be just supporting the brand, supporting sales, and maybe not lose money, but just break even. That's the focus. Yep. And I'm fairly certain that was our goal at Rolex. Was we weren't there to make money. We had to cover costs if we were building a new workshop, buying new equipment. You know, obviously you'd be spending a lot of money then, and you had to cover costs and everything. But it was always the idea that we're supporting the company so that it looks good and it helps with sales.
Yeah, but Rolex is like a foundation. You know, they don't have to keep any shareholders happy either. Really, they've got stakeholders, but not. You know.
Yeah, that's true. It's a different company like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different structure. I mean, it's quite, and that's what everyone forgets about. Even in Switzerland, you know, in Switzerland they're a bit more savvy. They're onto it, but. Anywhere else in the world, you know, Rolex, Omega, they're all competitors, same thing, same company. I mean, same sort of structure. No, they're nothing like each other. Rolex is just such a different beast that people...
They're almost independent, aren't they? Even though they're so large, it's like...
Totally independent foundation. It's not even it's a non-profit foundation. It's nuts. So all their profit goes back into the company or to charities or to guys like you or research and design. So that's why they can spend 10, 20 years working on a new movement. You know, it's kind of...
So, Michael, so you're servicing all these watches now as an independent watchmaker. Why should people send their watch to you if they've got a Rolex to service? Why would somebody send a watch to you rather than to Rolex? What's the added value people get sending their watch to an independent rather than to the manufacturer?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I know.
It's a really good question. And as you were saying, I was like, Jesus, I'm just going to say, I don't know. I can't explain it. No. I think what you get is it's a little bit more tailored with me. So when you go to Rolex, you expect to get the same sort of service worldwide. They do everything really well. You put the watch in, it comes back as new as they can get it, basically. They replace parts. It comes back and it's doing the job. It'll do the job that it was designed to do originally, and that's what they want to do. So if you take in a vintage Submariner, they will, or a Sea Dweller, they will go through it and try and bring it back to a point where it was originally designed to actually go underwater. And even the vintage Sea Dwellers, testing the valves, the helium escape valve, they do all of that. Even though these watches probably aren't going to go in the water because they're rare vintage watches, they bring it back to that. So I offer a different kind of service where if a customer doesn't want the watch polished or they don't want these hands replaced because the luminous is maybe a little bit unstable or whatever, you know, I can get around that and maybe strengthen the luminous on the hands I tailor the service a little bit more for customers. But if with modern watches, I recommend taking them to Rolex because they've got all the right tooling for them, and anything that's vintage and it's becoming a little more tricky and they don't want certain parts replaced, then that's sort of where I come in. But anything modern, then there's no reason to
with the brand specific stuff these days, and the movements are so special, and you know,
with the casing, even the casings now are so different with the tools and everything. So Rolex have got everything there.
You don't have to answer this, but I mean, I don't know, is there many people in Australia that would do test a watch to 500 meters or 300 meters with a proper, you got proper vacuum, I mean, for that?
Yeah, there'd be a lot of workshops, independent people around that have got equipment that test watches to that. But the watches I work on generally, we're not talking about them going in water generally. So
No. I mean, we used to test to 100 meters or even 200, but anything, it seems like anything over that, anything that's serious dive watches, you struggle to find someone who's got the vacuum pumps for it. I don't know. Yeah. It's sort of...
Well, someone like Michael Presser will have...
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, someone like that. He'll have the right equipment to test watches to a certain depth. And,
yeah, okay.
So there's independent watchmakers around that have that equipment, but yeah, then it comes, you know, if you've got a
deep
sea,
that's less though. Yeah,
deep sea, you know, you got to test to like 4,000.
Yeah, that's 4, thing, exactly. It's pretty much it's a different.
What about how difficult is it with? Because what I hear a lot or see a lot is kind of independent workshops complaining about the big brands kind of pushing them out in terms of giving them access to parts and stuff like that, it's increasingly difficult for the independents. They have to jump through more hoops and stuff like that to be able to get access. So is it easy for you to get stuff, or is it just because you're a kind of ex Rolex person and still obviously dedicated to the brand in general that you have access to the parts needed, or do you even find that you struggle?
I don't get access to their parts. I'm just resourceful. I've got
well, I guess that's proper watchmaking then, isn't it?
It is. And, yeah, and some people can't work like that. Some people, if they're given the job like mine and working for themselves, they won't be able to figure out how to fix a part or how to find that part somewhere. And
that's what I've heard as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was, when I was at Rolex, I was one of the people, unfortunately, and I'll probably get a lot of hate for this, I was one of the people that was
all refusing for parts,
shutting down certain workshops.
Boo.
because of the work, we felt it wasn't up to a certain standard. So people would come from Geneva, and we would talk about certain workshops that used to get parts, and we would discuss the workshops and the level of work, and so I was all for saying no, I don't think Rolex should share parts, and I can explain why as well, because with so many customers I come across, and I've come across many customers that own Rolex or Patek or Audemars, and they have a bad taste in their mouth with those brands because they've taken those watches sometimes to watchmakers that aren't qualified. They're not official service, and the watch may not run for a couple of years, and they still will say, oh, the brand is crap. Oh, this watch never runs well. You know, and that's why Rolex don't want anyone else that isn't officially trained or can replace the parts properly to work on these watches, because it'll make the brand look bad. You'll have a customer out there with a watch that's not running correctly. It might be gaining too much or losing or stopping, and they're just like, this watch is crap. I took it to a watchmaker and you know, it's still running bad, you know.
There must be guys in between there somewhere. I guess it's discretionary, really. I mean, there's some little watchmakers, some little workshops, and watchmakers are very competent watchmakers, and it's not just Rolex, but they still can't get the parts from different, like you. Yeah,
yeah. You bring it to me, it'll be no problem. But I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about other people.
But then people that might not be able to get parts for Omega or parts for, they might do all the rest of the watches in this collection for this guy, and he's very competent and everything, but they can't get a Zenith part or a Patek part or whatever, because they can't get a seal. You know, they can't even do a proper service because they can't get a back seal or whatever.
I mean modern stuff, yes, fair enough. Modern stuff, it's a bit difficult, but if you're resourceful enough and you know certain people, you can get certain things. And I know our family business, even Woods Jewelers, it's been open since 1956. So they've got a stock of parts going back years and years, because,
and that's what you have to be willing to have, a stock.
Vintage Omega and Rolex stock. And yeah, exactly. And my dad has always just built up that stock of parts, and I used to think he was wasting time, you know, putting
now cataloging
all these parts and putting them away, and the amount of times I go into those drawers for a vintage Omega part or something is incredible. It's
And you still get to work on some nice pieces?
Yeah, I do. I get to work on great stuff.
We're talking on the other, who are we talking with, Charles, something about vintage Longines and some other little brands, you know, Movado and all this different stuff. Longines in particular. I mean, I know Malik's a bit of a Falmer fan as well, but
Longines is right.
The old ones are amazing, basically. Yeah, I mean, the movements.
They're fantastic. Some of the old chronographs and yeah, great quality. Longines is beautiful.
Longines. It's probably a good it's a good one for people to invest in. But people like us who can't afford proper, I mean, high end.
Proper.
You know, for an accessible, you know, to get a nice movement, basically. It's like the old, same level as old Omegas and everything else. But you're a bit of a collection. You were talking about a Bremont at one point. Do you know the Bremont, the English guys, the English brothers?
Yeah, Nick and Giles. I haven't met them yet, but I'll be going over there for training at some stage.
Oh, do you have the brand in the shop now?
I've been connected with them. I've been assigned as I'll be doing official service for them. But because of the coronavirus, everything's been put on hold. So I was supposed to be going for training at some stage this year, and we don't know when it'll be. But mainly training on the casing and stuff. Yeah, it'll be good. Yes. It'll be good.
Special sort of casing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And you know Stephen McDonald?
Yeah. No, I don't know, but yeah. No,
well, he developed the perpetual calendar for MBNF. He's now working with them, developing...
Oh, yes.
Oh, he's doing his own movement, for them. Yeah.
This brand is going to be, it's going to be something. I mean, it's already something impressive. And I think
since they've been around, basically.
The way the cases are made and the money that the money they're putting into this company, I see it almost as I can compare it to Rolex back in the 40s or 50s, when they started putting watches on explorers and certain people, and they started developing watches that could do more, go into different places. And that's what I compare them to Rolex back in the day, in the early days. And that's why I think this company is going to be something. They're going to continue to grow.
I can imagine they're a bit less. You can still have a good time with them, but I don't know. I know Giles. A bit, not Nick at all. I think I've spoken to Nick once, but Giles and I've met him talked to me a few times, and he's a good guy. I know the guy here. What's his name? Nick Hooper. But they're just great guys. Again, that's the big difference with them and Rolex. I think they're just fun guys, and Giles especially. I think he's a really cool guy, and they're just the whole brand, how they've developed the whole thing, and all the stuff they do for all the middle, all the squadrons and stuff. And yeah, they've done really, really good stuff.
They seem to be having fun. I think that's the most important thing. They're obviously enjoying what they're doing. I was actually listening to a podcast the other day, and it was a podcast specifically about military watches. I think it was like Zulu ZT podcast, Zulu Time podcast, something like that. And they had a guy on who was ex-SAS, and a guy who was an ex-paratrooper, and these were all people in England. And every single person on the show had a Bremont.
Seriously?
And they were just they were just banging on about Bremont all the time, and how they would go diving in them and stuff like that. And yeah, they were so invested in the brand. And I think it goes to show, if you spend the time, and they've really cultivated that marketplace, that military marketplace. I remember when I went to the Bremont boutique opening in Melbourne, and they had a guy there who'd ejected, and he was talking to people and saying how he was like 4 inches shorter after ejecting, and how traumatizing it was. And it's just like, it was a brand fully invested in the people who they were selling the watches to. And I think if you do that, you can't help but be successful, for sure.
Exactly. These watches are on a lot of military people. They supply to military in the UK, Australia. And the materials they use. I've got my MB2, the hardened steel. I can't scratch that. If I got a screwdriver or tweezers and went across that steel, it doesn't scratch. It's heavy steel, but it's incredible. But
listen, we'll go out drinking one night and we'll see how the watch is afterwards.
But when I got that MB2, because I ordered the MB2 through them when we were in chat talking, and I said to them, could you put like my business logo on the dial? You know, so I'm sort of like a partner. I'm connected now. And they just said, no, unfortunately, that's only for military. You know, we can only put stuff on the dial for military.
You just got to call your business, make it your business some sort of military entity where you can work something out.
I was told no. I was told no. If you're part of a squadron, you can be. And I said, all right, so I've got to start up a squadron.
Yeah, okay. Start your own squadron. Okay.
I was an air cadet at one point, so maybe I need to
throw that into that.
Yeah, that was it for about 2.5 weeks. I was an air cadet, so yeah, maybe.
You qualify. You get your name on the dial for sure. We used to sell them at the first shop. When I came back to Perth, the guy I worked for, we sold them in the shop. I sold a few of them, and they were always a great watch. And it was just an interesting story. You know, the marketing was right. It wasn't just a PR rubbish. I always had a soft spot. I like that. The 247, the titanium GMT, the Boeing one, the grey one with a Boeing hand because I used to work on Boeing. I mean, I used to work for Qantas years back. And I just had that's still one I want. It's on my list, you know. If one comes up, I don't want to pay full mozza for it, but if one comes up one day, I'll so keep an eye out, will you? Let me know.
Yeah, yeah, now exactly. you've got an N with the brand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just like that they make their own stuff. They're not getting. I mean, their movements at the moment are they use, you know, ETA based and they're reliable. But the casing, they make the casing and everything, which is the investment they've made in the machines to make the casing and everything. It's incredible. It's
I just find them a bit big for my little pigeon wrists. Most the only one that pigeons. That really. Yeah, I know. Apart from your 34mm shooter you've got on. But I love the design, really, really love the design, but I just find most of them are a bit big, apart from the Supermarine, which I thought was great, and it still has that, it's all about the case, really. But if they can keep on doing the stuff that they're doing with the case, and then, like you say, have an in-house movement, then that'll be a total game changer for them. No one will be able to because that's been the only kind of criticism so far is the kind of no in-house movement part of it. Yeah.
But you know, I'm not a big fan of in-house anyway, but anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it'd be a good plus, I think, for them. Okay, that's the Poms. What about the Paddies? Yes. The Irish, you've been over there. You've been McGonagall's, you know them? You've been there or?
I met Stephen years ago when I was at WASTEP. We were out at a bar one night having a drink and he was with Steve McDonald. Now we're at a nightclub. I can't remember. I think it was called Highlander or something.
Oh, not Highlander.
Yeah. Oh man, we had
a good Scottish nightclub. Yeah.
We had some big nights in Highlander.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you were.
We had some big nights in Ireland. But I haven't. I wanted to meet John last year when I was in Ireland, and I was emailing him, and then he was overseas, and we couldn't. And then I went to Switzerland, and we couldn't meet up. But next time I go back to Ireland, I want to visit him in Athlone.
Yeah, for sure. And they even got their. I mean, they've got their sister doing the engraving and stuff. I mean, Charles Turl was talking about meeting another brother over in the States. They're all over the shop, but. Yeah, the two, John and Steve, I think they're going to start, they've got to sort of do their own thing, each one now. I'm not sure if they're sort of splitting a bit or something. I'm not sure that could be I'm not sure if that's public yet, but I mean, I think they were going to do that.
Yeah, now.
Is now, yeah. No, well, they were talking about it.
Press release.
Yeah, just come out. It's a scoop.
Well, Stephen spends most of his time in Switzerland, doesn't he?
Yes, exactly. John, he's based in Switzerland. John's in Ireland, so it's sort of.
He's in Ireland, exactly.
I mean, they've always got on fine and they've done their projects and done their stuff. But I guess both of them have done in the past a lot of contract work for other guys. But I'm not sure whether it's a whole new era for them. But they're both, regardless, they're both just great guys and funny guys. They're just so hilarious. But it's next level. Well, we had a good chat there. I don't know. We didn't really, we went around in circles a little bit, but not too much. I don't know.
That was fun.
Is that good?
Kind of the right amount of going around in circles for our podcast.
Yep, that's fun.
Okay, so I should let you finish off, Alex. Do you want to? We're going to do a little someone to follow. You got to,
yeah, of course.
Is that the next
Jedley? We're all going to pick Jedley one.
Yeah, Jedley. That's what I was going to.
Yeah. So I've got some guy. Yeah, JEDL.
Yeah.
Hang on, I'm taking notes here. Oh, I've got him already.
Got him. Ah, damn it. Yeah. Okay, who wants to go first?
You go first.
Me? Okay. So we're shooting ourselves in the foot here about Basel World, but I'm going to recommend another podcast.
What?
Which I started to listen. I know. And wait, it gets worse. It's a booze and watches podcast. It's called The Whiskey and What? I know.
Really?
And, but they started after us, so maybe they've stolen our drink check thing.
Hang on,
but
Whiskey. Yeah.
Don't, are you going to leave already, Michael? Michael's going to go and do a double header and he's going to go and do a podcast with him afterwards so you can continue drinking on into the night.
Sorry, I just need to clarify. Are we recommending podcasts?
No.
It's an Instagram account, but it's connected to a podcast.
Ah, okay. Gotcha.
Don't worry, I'm not moving the goalposts. Gotcha. Just kind of last minute.
That'll be so okay. I can wing it.
This is a podcast. It's called Whiskey and Watches, and their Instagram is whiskey.and.watches.podcast. And I was speaking to a guy called What? You follow them already?
Yeah.
So the guy's called Spence. So it's Spence and Evan, I think. I was speaking to the guy called Spence, and we were kind of, I was discussing with him the difficulties that you can have when starting up a podcast, and the technical issues that I'm all too familiar with from doing podcasts with you, Rob.
We are all too familiar with, yes.
Yes, we, yeah. So, but yeah, just nice guys. I've listened to a couple of their podcasts. Like I like listen to watch stuff when I'm at the bench, and their stuff's pretty good. And they had a couple of digs at Hodinkee as well on their podcast as well. So yeah, I'm all over that. So yeah, Whiskey and Watches podcast. That's my one.
Yeah, found it. Spence and Evan. Yep.
Yeah.
Got that.
I've got I've got a lady called Dr. Yellow.
Never heard of her.
Never heard of her. She's a doctor. Okay. No. Dr. Co in New York, I think she's based. She's an American. She's an anesthetist or something, but she's a bit like the old watch lady, you know, that lady. Some really impressive pieces. A really cool car. She's just one of those ladies that seems like she's really into it, and she's a serious collector. A few vintage pieces and some she knows the big brands. Basically, she's got a bit of everything. Really cool photos though, nice photos. So that's Dr. Yellow. So name I've been following. I think I cheated. I found her in some article from one of our competing podcasts or a magazine or an article somewhere. But
really she's got some FP.
Yeah. That's what I was going to mention. She has FP George. I think
Vacheron. Yeah.
So for some reason, there's lots of Dr. Yellows on Instagram. So you have to
Dr. Iris Co is her name, and that's probably there somewhere. If you go through it's just Dr. Yellow, all one word. I think that's
the one. Yep, perfect.
Yeah, okay, that's a bit of a different one.
Okay, Jedley, what have you got?
I'm gonna mention my family business. That's what I'm gonna
do. Absolutely. Oh,
Jesus. This is not This is as bad as Rob when he's promoting his straps all the time.
We've talked about mine three times tonight, so yeah.
No, you're loving it. I can hear you salivating.
This is the shop that I started. This is Woods Jewelers. So Woods_Jewelers. So everyone go and follow them, and
you get three more followers now.
We've got three watchmakers, including myself, my father, and my brother. And then my uncle's a clockmaker. So Colac is described as like the centre of watchmaking in Australia. It's a bit like Neuchâtel. It's like the Neuchâtel of Australia. Yeah, it's so the amount of watchmakers per capita in Colac. And then my cousin came from here as well. Yep. So go follow Woods_Jewelers, and you can
third generation jewelers and watchmakers. It says here, so you're the third generation.
I'm the third generation. Yep.
Okay.
There's not too many that can claim that. Really.
No. And if you want custom jewelry, they deal in vintage watches.
With straps, leather straps.
When it says here, do not contact us about Panerai reference numbers. We don't know. Okay, good. That's definitely your family business then. That's good.
I've got to talk about Fifth Wrist. Follow Fifth Wrist. Go and do some reviews on the Fifth Wrist website. I keep forgetting, Alex. You at the end of each one, you say, "Oh, what are you going
to
do?"
You need to stop tagging as Fifth Wrist Radio on your Instagram post, because it just goes to a page that doesn't exist. Okay, first of all,
No. It's just a tag, Alex. I am complete.
You can do hashtag Fifth Wrist Radio. You cannot do at Fifth Wrist Radio because the page doesn't exist.
I didn't do it at.
But yes.
Man. You did.
Yeah. So come and leave a review. Actually, while Michael's here, so as part of our review of the year award, I'm modifying a Legend Diver.
Oh, yes.
Which is going to be short. And Michael was supposed to come back to me and tell me if he had any sand left for his sandblasting machine, and he was too busy telling me how high he was in the morning. He was too high to remember to tell me if he had any sand left for his sandblasting machine.
I'm sorry, I'm setting a reminder now.
Okay,
I'm setting a reminder now, so tomorrow I'm gonna go down there or speak to my dad or my brother and say, look, have you got any sand there? Because it's a pain in the ass wanting to sandblast a case.
You knew you got your near for something.
And, and if not, I've got a friend that's got a sandblasting machine. We can
good.
Get it sorted.
So yeah, come and review your watch on fifthwrist.com, and maybe you can, if you write a half decent one, or it'd probably have to be a better than half decent one, you can be in the running for the Writer of the Year award, which is a Legend Diver, which may or may not be sandblasted by the time you win it. Come and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Definitely go and check out the video Rob and I did, which was quite a long one, even by your standards, on
this was
on Geneva Blue YouTube channel.
Geneva
How long was it? It was like an hour, was
I
it?
Forget. No, it wasn't quite.
It's pretty long.
Anyway, it wasn't as long as this podcast. By golly.
Yeah. Go and follow Rob, Geneva_Blue_ on Instagram. Don't
follow him physically. That's a bit spooky.
Don't follow. Yeah, don't follow him. Although you probably would like that. Go and check out his website. Go and buy one of the great straps that fits Panerai's with miscellaneous reference numbers. Yeah, you've had enough plugs. Michael's.
Now you can even come to me to buy the straps.
Exactly.
If you want, you sell them as well.
I'll be selling them. If you want someone in, Victoria and Melbourne, I can get them to you. So. Yeah.
But no 19 mil, right?
Not yet. Oh, they're coming. Sorry. They're coming.
First Omega Space owners need not apply.
Are you finished?
And yeah, go and follow. Shut up. Go and follow Michael Woods Watchmaking on Instagram.
No. It's just Woods Watchmaking.
No, Michael.
That's
involved.
What I said.
Oh, you said Michael.
I said go and follow Michael Woods Watchmaking. Okay. I did too. Can you pay attention? But he doesn't want any modern watches. Yeah, he says always go and take the modern watches back to the manufacturer. He only wants old stuff that's fallen to bits, right?
Oh, whatever. I'll fix anything. Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for joining us, Michael. It was brilliant.
It's been great. It's been fun.
Thanks to all our listeners.
All the people in Kenya. Stay safe, stay indoors, and stay on time.